Please, the court. In the state XREL GMAC versus Standridge, this court held that a counterclaim for malicious prosecution may be filed in the same action in which the underlying case is pending. However, in that case, this court also made clear that its ruling did not affect the substantive rights of the parties, only the right to file that claim as a counterclaim. The well-established substantive law of malicious prosecution, both in Missouri and elsewhere, is that a claim for malicious prosecution is not cognizable until after a final adverse disposition of the underlying claim.
Isn't that exactly what State XREL General Motors v. Standridge says? It says his claim became cognizable where the substantive rights of the parties were determinable. Once GMAC dismissed this claim, plaintiffs dismissed their claim against defendant.
That is correct. And those were the facts in that case, Judge Stitt, that in fact, in that case, the underlying claim had been determined. And therefore, it was appropriate for the counterclaim for malicious prosecution to proceed. Unlike those facts, in this case, the underlying claim has not been determined, has not even come for trial, much less gone through the appeal process.
Yet why can't you cure it by way of a jury instruction?
Well, Your Honor, the problem here is that as a matter of substantive law, it's not a claim which can be submitted. It's not a claim which is recognized under the law until such time as there's been an adverse determination. That's one of the elements of a malicious prosecution claim. Besides the fact that the substantive law doesn't even recognize this claim until the disposition of the pending claim, by allowing evidence of that would support the malicious prosecution claim to be heard by a jury that's trying the underlying claim, there's a substantial possibility of prejudice to the party bringing the underlying claim. I use as an example in my brief attorney's fees, which would be the primary evidence of damages on a malicious prosecution claim. If a jury finds in favor of the plaintiff, that is the party bringing the underlying claim, yet has heard substantial evidence from the other side of attorney's fees, which would otherwise be inadmissible if the claim was filed separately, there's a substantial possibility of prejudice in the jury's confusion, at a minimum, by having heard that evidence and not knowing what to do with it. So both as a matter of substantive law, as well as a matter of substantial possibility of prejudice, and also the substantial possibility of inconsistent verdicts that a jury might end up rendering, the law is well established, and I have found no other jurisdiction which would allow, under any version of what we have as Rule 5506B, to have these claims tried together, and I think for good reason. The language in the court's opinion, as I stated, merely states that under 5506B, a claim may be filed, but it doesn't in any way undermine the substantive law which I just described.
Would the party filing this prosecution claim be prejudiced in any way if they filed a separate action after the original?
Not at all, Judge. This is not by any means a compulsory counterclaim. It was strictly permissive. And in fact, under the law that's been in place for years, and I think is the law in most other states, that claim, in fact, cannot be even filed before the original claim has been adversely determined. They would certainly not be prejudiced.
But if the plaintiff wins, there's no malicious prosecution.
Then it's moot. That's exactly right. And it's moot. And that would be the same here in this case. If the trial of the malicious prosecution action is deferred until after we have a full and adverse determination of the underlying claim, if the claim is found in favor of the plaintiff, then the counterclaim also becomes moot and is unnecessary to try it, which is another reason why I think there is great prejudice to the plaintiff for trying a claim that may very well turn out to be moot as a matter of law and having a jury determine the plaintiff's claim based in part on evidence that If the claim for malicious prosecution were separately filed, evidence of the attorney's fees of the, in this case, the counterclaimant, would clearly not be admissible in the trial of the underlying claim.
That part of your argument, though, doesn't that happen routinely when there is a counterclaim where evidence that would not otherwise be admissible comes in. So somehow our system, we have the presumption that the jurors follow follow the instructions and render verdicts under those circumstances.
No,
go ahead.
The difference, Your Honor, is in each of those other cases where there's a claim, let's say for a breach of contract, and a counterclaim for a breach of contract, each of those claims is cognizable as a matter of law.
So that, to me, that's a much stronger point, that you can't try a claim.
It's not right, essentially. And so we're trying a hypothetical claim, essentially, by a counterclaim for malicious prosecution. That, I think, as a matter of substantive law, is the error. And again, I've found no other court in this country. I will not say that I've done exhaustive law review research, but based on the research I found no other jurisdictions which allows that. It is not a matter of judicial discretion, as urged by the defendants. While I certainly concede that matters of whether trials should be held separately or together is generally a matter of the trial court's discretion, this is a matter of substantive law. And the court's opinion in Standridge clearly made it perfectly clear that by allowing the counterclaim for malicious prosecution, it was not in any way avoiding or changing the underlying substantive law of malicious prosecution. Therefore, I submit to the court that the trial court here was wrong to deny the motion for separate trial and defer that trial until after the final adverse determination of the underlying claims, and that this court should issue its writ of prohibition. And furthermore, I would ask the court to clarify in its decision the extent to which Standridge to the effect that while such claims can be filed, they cannot be trialed simultaneously with the underlying claim.
Could the case have been bifurcated? I mean, could the trial court have allowed the joinder but then bifurcated the two issues?
Certainly. Bifurcation would be another possibility. There's no reason that, whether you call it separate trial or bifurcation, the fact of the matter is until such time as the substantive law allows the malicious prosecution claim to proceed, it's error to go ahead and combine the two. But whether you do it by motion separate trial, to bifurcate a trial, severance, whatever remedy is available under the rules, I think makes no substantive difference. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have time on rebuttal. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I apologize. I'm a little bit under the weather, so I've got a little bit of a frog in my throat, so I'll try to make it through this. I don't think I should have a problem. I'd also like to introduce my associate, Jason Turk, who helped me draft this brief, and so he's sitting here with me today. This case, as Mr. Kozlowski indicated, is about a writ of prohibition with respect to our counterclaim for malicious prosecution. In the underlying case, this is a case where the plaintiff has brought a cause for basically a 14-year-old oral contract. They previously brought the case, and that case was dismissed by the plaintiff without prejudice about 10 days prior to the earlier trial. Interestingly enough, both of those cases have been handled by the same trial judge, Judge Vinson. And so in this instance, this judge has a full knowledge of the history of these cases, and he had that knowledge when he made the decision to deny the plaintiff's motion for separate trials. What is clear from Mr. Kozlowski's brief and from his argument is that he is asking this court basically to overrule the Standridge case and to, on a writ of prohibition, change Rule 55.06.
How is he doing that? Because in the part I read, it seems to say the counterclaim for malicious prosecution only became cognizable after the first one was dismissed, because only at that point were the substantive rights of the parties determinable. Exactly what he's asking us to hold here.
Yes.
Why would that have to be overruled to find for him?
Because the specific language used in the Standridge case was that a counterclaim for malicious prosecution may be brought in
absolutely
the case.
But that's a different, there's two issues. One, can it be joined? And in your brief, what I'd like you to address, you seem to assume if it can be brought, can be joined, if we read the rule to include it, then automatically that means you get to submit it to the jury at the same time. And it's not clear to me why one follows from the other, because it seems like GMAC says that's not the case, that it's only when the plaintiff's claim was dismissed with prejudice that the other claim became cognizable. So they draw a distinction between joining it in the pleadings and submitting it.
And Judge Stitt, let me address that specific issue. That case standard has to be looked at in light of both Rule 55.06 and Rule 66.02. What I respectfully believe that this court and the rules have set up is a situation where under Rule 55.06, the counterclaim can specifically be joined as part of the case in the interest of judicial economy. Then we turn to Rule 66.02, which gives the trial court discretion to determine whether claims which are properly joined in the same action should be tried together.
Does it give them discretion to submit a claim that has not yet arisen, that's not cognizable, that is not yet determinable? I think you read why would we read all that into saying the trial court has discretion if, in fact, the claim doesn't exist until the first claim ends in a final judgment?
One of the elements of the claim has not been satisfied yet until there is a final judgment. I certainly understand that. But in the interest of judicial economy, it's important for the trial judge to have the discretion in order to try them together, because the evidence, especially in this case, the evidence is going to be so similar that those claims should be tried together in order to not put the parties in a position of having to try the same case twice.
Wouldn't we have to overrule GMAC to find for you, though, because it says it's not cognizable or determinable until after, but it's only cognizable and determinable because the plaintiff's claim was dismissed. So it's really the other way, it seems like.
With all due respect,
I
disagree.
Yeah, no, I want your response, yeah.
what I understand the GMAC case to be saying is that when it talks about the substantive rights, it says that what it's looking to do there is to make sure that there is no inconsistent decision which is reached by the trial judge. For example, ultimately, what I would envision is jury instructions which say you have to first determine whether or not the plaintiff's breach of contract claim you find in favor of the plaintiff or defendant. If you find in favor of the defendant, then you go to the certain instruction and determine whether or not there is a finding in favor of the defendants on their counterclaim. I think this is an issue which, as Judge Draper suggested, can be resolved by properly instructing the jury.
Go ahead.
Well, if you're right, why wouldn't we have a malicious prosecution counterclaim in every case?
Judge Wilson, I think that's a fair question. But I also understand that in our practice, we look and evaluate our cases and decide whether or not there is a basis to bring that claim. I'm a trial attorney. I don't bring a malicious prosecution case in every case where I am defending. Also, I think there are a number of protections built into the system to protect a plaintiff from an abuse of that type of claim. First of all, there is a motion for separate trials where the trial judge can, in its discretion, decide whether or not in that particular case it's appropriate to try them together. Further, if the malicious prosecution claim has no merit, there are motions to dismiss, there are motions for judgment on the pleadings, there are motions for summary judgment.
How can you file a motion to dismiss until you know the result of the first trial?
Well, if there is no basis, more or less, if you didn't properly plead it, I think probably more appropriately a motion for summary judgment. If there is no evidence that is derived through discovery that the malicious prosecution claim, or excuse me, that the underlying claim was brought frivolously or with malice or with no good faith basis, then that case can be resolved on summary judgment. I think to any counterclaim, as I think was pointed out earlier, any counterclaim can be brought for improper purposes.
But
or
this is a uniquely disfavored claim, you would agree, right? This claim is disfavored at least as much as any I'm aware of.
It obviously, as Mr. Kozlowski cited, we want to encourage the unfettered access to the courts. But I also think it's fair to say that we don't want to encourage frivolous or malicious use of the courts. And so it is an important protection for defendants who are hauled into court for the wrong reasons, when there is a lack of good faith, when there is malice, for them to be able to defend themselves. And in our system, the American system, where we don't award attorney's fees in a typical case just because you lost, in a case where, as I believe in this case, the plaintiff has brought the lawsuit for the wrong reasons, out of malice, without good faith, there needs to be a protection there.
But you have a protection, you have a remedy. If you win the case against the plaintiff, then you can bring a malicious prosecution case without any prejudice whatsoever.
And Judge Teitelman, you earlier brought up the issue as to whether or not there is prejudice, and I want to address that and your comment there. I believe there is, in this instance, would be prejudice to the defendants in forcing this case to be brought later, as opposed to as under 5506, it can be joined in this claim. And I think the facts to this specific case are important to understand that. In this case, the plaintiff alleges an oral contract back in 2000 with respect to a real estate development project. In his answers to interrogatories, he identified 9 individuals who he said had knowledge and information about this agreement between the plaintiff and the defendant for the plaintiff to get a 25% cut in this. I have taken 8 of the 9 people's depositions, and none of them know anything about this alleged oral agreement.
But so, those depositions can be used in both parts of the case because it can be joined, if it can be joined under the rule. That's not a reason you have to duplicate that effort, even if the court holds you can't submit them at the same time.
I agree, Judge Stiff. I wouldn't have to take the depositions again necessarily, but I would have to call those 8 or 9 people to come testify in 2 separate trials. We would have to educate 2 separate judges, 2 separate juries on these issues, and there is a prejudice to the plaintiff to having to do that in this particular case.
If it can be brought in the same action, it's presumably the same judge.
Same judge, or then 2 separate juries, right. And you're also hauling these 8 or 9 witnesses out of their daily lives into the court to testify 2 separate times, basically to the same facts and evidence.
Do you concede that you do not have a submissible case on a malicious prosecution claim? At this time, you have no evidence of one of the elements of malicious prosecution.
Judge Breckenridge, you're absolutely correct. One of the elements of the claim is...
So how can... If we're looking at your interpretation of GMAC versus Standridge or your opponent, how can a ruling stand? I know of, and maybe you know of, is there any other circumstance in which we would adopt a position that allows a case to be tried when there's no evidence of an element? But as a matter of law, you have no evidence of an element of the offense.
Certainly it would not be... The jury instructions would not allow the jury to find in favor.
What I'm asking is there any other circumstance in our law that allows a case to be tried when, as a matter of law, the plaintiff cannot present proof of an element of the case?
I believe, Judge Breckenridge, that Rule 55.06 refers to a specific other example, which is a fraudulent conveyance claim. It is somewhat ironic, in this case, that the plaintiff who is complaining about a counterclaim being brought, which is not cognizable until there is a finding, is also bringing a fraudulent conveyance claim in his own petition, which is not cognizable until there's a finding under his breach of contract claim. And so I think that is somewhat ironic.
How do you survive a motion for summary judgment on your counterclaim?
On my counterclaim?
If there's a motion for summary judgment filed that says there's no evidence of this element, which is the resolution of that case, how does it survive summary judgment?
Well, if the motion were purely on that element, Your Honor, I would say that the standards case and the rules provide that I can survive that summary judgment because the cases are allowed to be joined together. But they could certainly move for summary judgment on whether or not I've shown malice, or lack of good faith, or damages, or things like that.
Even if you're right, 5506 is just a pleading.
If it's just a pleading, if the
his question is now you've pled it. Now, how can you get to trial with absolutely no proof of one of the necessary elements?
And I think, in Judge Wilson and Judge Fisher, I understand what you're saying. I understand the issue with respect to that particular element. But this claim and a fraudulent conveyance claim, they are somewhat unique in the causes of action that are available to parties. However, in these particular instances, judicial economy, the ability to have, my understanding is that the law generally tries to get parties who have disputes to get all of those disputes resolved at one time. We don't always require it, but it is always encouraged, because then, in this instance, if we didn't do that, we would have potentially three separate lawsuits between the same parties on the same issues. There would be the breach of contract claim, there would be the plaintiff's fraudulent conveyance claim, and then there would be our counterclaim. But three separate cases.
Are you now arguing that it's a compulsory counterclaim? And if you hadn't brought it, it would be waived?
No, I don't think it's a compulsory counterclaim, but it is certainly something which I believe that the law and the court should encourage the parties to resolve all of their disputes in the same case at the same time,
but,
if possible.
But are you arguing what could be a change in the landscape? I mean, is the culture that when these two types of claims are filed, that they are brought, you know, back to back, that they're not brought contemporaneously? I mean, is that what the culture has been in the practice of law? I mean, are you advocating a big change in the landscape here, where it's been routinely thought of that, you know, you file your cause of action, and then if you lose, then you consider the, or if you're the winning defendant, then you consider filing the a malicious prosecution case? Is that the norm?
Judge Russell, I've been practicing 20 years. certainly a lot shorter than the many and longer than some. My understanding has been that such a claim could be brought as a counterclaim or subsequent to, as a separate action subsequent to it. What I'm suggesting is that the law should allow for it to be brought as a counterclaim so that the parties may resolve all of their disputes in one case, and that we trust in the trial judge to use his or her discretion to determine whether or not they can and should be tried at the same time. If there is any prejudice or asserted prejudice, Mr. Kozlowski talks about evidence of attorney's fees. If you look at the Black versus Veach case that we cited in our brief, that was something where one of the parties alleged that if you allow this claim to be tried at the same time as another claim, that there's going to be prejudice to me. That was handled by instructions to the jury. We assume that the jury will follow the instructions and will set aside the evidence of attorney's fees or other things until they've made the proper determination.
The language in 5506 talks about joining claims, and if you look at the rest of Rule 55, it talks about joining claims by a single party. A single party may join more than one claims under the circumstances that are addressed there. It's not talking about joining claims by adverse parties. So the federal rule that this was based on has been construed, so far as I know, only to mean that a party can bring two claims even though the second is dependent on the outcome of the first. It's never been construed to mean that you can bring a claim like yours that's dependent, brought by an adverse party that is dependent upon the plaintiff's claim failing. And I haven't found any state or federal claim case that references or approves of them being tried in the same trial. Have you?
Judge Wilson, I read the Standards decision as allowing that to be done as a counterclaim, that's specifically what Judge White indicated could be done under Rule 55.06. And if you look at footnote 4 to his decision, he then specifically says any cases which are inconsistent with that holding are hereby overruled.
But why is that correct as to malicious prosecution or as to counterclaims? I mean, it said that. Was that correct? What in the rule says it applies to counterclaims as opposed to a party joining their claims to prosecute them in a single action?
I don't believe there's a specific reference in the rule. I believe that's, I'm not going to argue that point, but I believe that the Standridge case, citing to Rule 55.06.
It assumes that they can be brought as a counterclaim,
yes,
and it applies here, but can you address the fact that apparently no case in the country allows that, and we would be the sole jurisdiction to allow that in malicious prosecution actions or counterclaims such as malicious prosecution?
Justice, I don't actually think we would be the only state. I know we took a look at the states, and I believe there were two. I think Washington was one.
Did you cite these in your brief?
I did not cite them, but I did anticipate it as a question, and I believe Washington was one, and the second one is escaping me right now. But the Washington one was by statute that specifically allowed that to be brought as a counterclaim. So if the court would like me to supplement my brief on that, I'd be happy to do so. But I believe that there are two states that specifically allow for a counterclaim for malicious prosecution.
If that's okay, supplement with that argument, just simply send the cites to the court and opposing counsel, and thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. I respectfully request that the writ be quashed, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Please, the court, just briefly. In response to a question, Judge Stith, that you asked, if the court were to allow the trial of these two cases together, it would not only be overruling the GMAC case, more importantly, it would be overruling decades and decades of law with respect to malicious prosecution, that is, allowing the trial of a case which is legally not cognizable.
Why couldn't you just file a motion for summary judgment and allege that he can produce no evidence that he has a final judgment?
Well, I guess that's possible, Judge, and in cases where the claims have been separately filed prematurely, in other words, had the defendants in this case filed a separate action, there's plenty of authority that says that should be dismissed, and a motion to dismiss would be proper in those cases. So you've given me a good idea. Well, and perhaps I'll follow through on that.
I wanted to give him an opportunity to respond to something I couldn't understand.
Well, I understand that, Judge, and I guess I was hoping that the trial judge would, in recognizing what this court said in Standridge, that the trial judge would agree to hold that trial in abeyance, but he did not, hence we're here.
Well,
maybe
I
could have gone another way. Maybe a motion for summary judgment would have been more appropriate.
And you agree Standridge doesn't say whether or not the claims can be tried together. It just says they may be joined.
That's correct.
There's no comment on that.
So then
why wouldn't 6602 kick in, which allows the trial court to have that discretion on what to try together for efficiency, what not to?
Because the trial court has discretion with regard to how he or she handles his docket and over procedural matters. It doesn't have discretion as to what the substantive law is. Its obligation is to apply the substantive law.
You respond a little differently to Judge Russell's question than to mine. You said it didn't address whether they're submissible together, but I thought you agreed. You said earlier that language about it's not cognizable or determinable until the first case is dismissed. Language and that we would have to overrule that to find for the other side. So those are not consistent.
I agree with you, Judge, and I didn't mean to be inconsistent. The court does say that. I think what I was responding to, and I thought what Chief Justice Russell was asking me was, did Standridge explicitly say you can file it, but you can't try it? And I think that question, frankly, has caused some problems. One of the cases, in fact, cited in the brief by the respondents is Greer versus McDonald. In that case, Judge Siegel, a very fine judge, well-experienced trial judge, did allow the submission of several claims to the jury simultaneously, including the malicious prosecution claim. Now, on appeal, the Court of Appeals never reached that issue, whether that was right or wrong. But obviously, Judge Siegel apparently believes that under Standridge you can try both of those cases to a jury, and I think some clarification of that ruling for his benefit as well as others throughout the state would be beneficial. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.